If you are looking for the Young Association of Western Mass, this is it. My name is Judy Hall, and I am a board member. And we are starting tonight with Double Trouble. The negative dynamics that emerge between partners in a committed relationship. Conflict, alienation, reactive emotion, unconscious projection. Oh my. Wow. I wanted to give you a little bit of information about the association. And we are we're going to be here this evening until 9, and there is no bathroom break, but please feel free using either door. The bathroom is just outside this door. We'll go till maybe 8:30-ish, and then there'll be questions, time for questions and dialogue. The organization has a, well, actually, first of all, I'm curious if there's anybody here for the first time. Great. Great. And how, in general, have you heard about it? Did you hear about it? How many people heard about it through the newspaper? Mike? Is Mike?
No, Thayer.
Oh, you heard about it through Thayer. Okay. Great. How about another person? Who heard about it through another person? And how about the website? What else? What about flyer? What have I forgotten?
Newspaper.
Newspaper. Yeah, I did that. Many of you perhaps are recurring, you know, are regulars. That's really wonderful. We do have a website. It's westmassyoung.org. And there's a email that we put out to remind people of upcoming lectures. So the website is chock full of great things, Jungian, in the area. And then the email sign-up, which is on the website, will send you a reminder about these lectures. The lectures occur the first Friday of every month, so usually, except for next month. In January, we're doing something special. We're having a 3-hour workshop. It's on January 11th. It's a lecture on Sunday. And there's a handout over here. It's the Dionysian Women's Initiation Mysteries at Pompeii. And it's by Erica Lorenz, who's an analyst. She's not here this evening, but like I said, there's a flyer right here.
Beautiful flyer that describes what's happening next month.
And she puts in parentheses, men included. So it's the women's mysteries, but men, of course, are welcome. So I want to introduce the board. One thing, because Penny is going to introduce Thayer. We do have flyers over here that if you know where you could put them up and post them, please take some. These are extras. Pass them around to friends. Also encourage people to sign up for the email list, which is also there, too, or to go on the website to sign up.
Money.
We ask for a donation. Great. Two baskets, $10 to $20. That helps us put on this lecture and also other to publicize these and also workshops that are held. There, every lecture is given by an analyst, union analyst. So they don't get paid for that, but
unless they're visitors.
Unless they're visitors, right. So the local analysts don't, but we bring in people from Boston, New York City, North Carolina. So, okay. So next month, I spoke about that. the board. So Dan is on our board and helps with all kinds of things, runs the website, and also helps with our techno end here. Carol, outreach, I guess, would be your title. And treasurer, important, very important. And if not, Erica and Thayer. Okay. Anything else?
Salon.
Yes, the salon. Afterwards, we go to the cafe, Mosaic Cafe on Masonic Street, which is just down the block past Sirius. That way, yes, thank you. And gather. There's yummy food, there's drinks there, and conversations. And I have heard 10 to 12 people are gathering there. I've been to them before, and there's passionate conversation. So these lectures inspire a lot of thoughts and questions, and so it's fun to gather as a group and, you know, converse and share. It enriches the experience. Okay, so Penny. Penny Tarasic is a Jungian analyst, and she was the Jung Institute of Boston's first student in 1979. She's been in practice for 45 years and has enjoyed many roles: a psychotherapist, analyst, teacher, group facilitator, supervisor, and director of curriculum at the Jung Institute of Boston. Thank you, Penny. Good evening. Can you hear in the back?
Yeah.
Okay.
It is my pleasure to introduce my dear friend and colleague, our elder, and a pioneer.
Really elder.
And pioneer in working with groups in process. Thayer is a rare extrovert in the Jungian world who has become deeply balanced and has moved toward introversion, particularly with the help of his cat. He is the beloved partner of another remarkable pioneer who has brought the body into consciousness and integrated it into Jungian theory. These were revolutionary concepts in the 1960s, in the field of psychology, and especially Jungian psychology. I first glimpsed Thayer and Anita 30 years ago at the Ghost Ranch conference in Abiquiu, New Mexico, and Thayer was daunting, and I was a candidate, and I did not speak to him, but I did. You know, he was the only extrovert, so just about. No, he was very impressive. And they have been, both of them, but particularly Thayer, I would say, of late, have been involved with this Western Massachusetts Jung Association for 18 years since its inception. And simultaneously, he has been deeply involved with the New England Society of Jungian Analysts in Boston. He's been a training analyst, faculty member, thesis advisor, and mentor to many candidates, and a generous supporter of the Institute. It was my pleasure when I returned to Massachusetts after being away 11 years in Santa Fe, and that was 2005, and I knew I was going to finally get to come back and get to know Thayer and Anita, and it's just been wonderful for me.
And us.
Yes. They are true friends, colleagues, and spiritual cohorts in this life's journey. He has ministered my soul as well. He is playful, wise, and holds, I really mean it when I say he holds the place of elder. He is a good enough father for so many, assisting in the healing of the father archetype for both men and women. It's wonderful to witness his continuing curiosity and evolution. He is continually becoming more human, more whole, more integrated, except the parts falling apart, which apparently happens to all of us as we get older. And I'm not idealizing there, and he will speak to this during his talk, I'm sure. I appreciate and enjoy your presence as a human, Thayer, you know that. A little background. As a young man, Thayer attended Amherst College. He also spent time in the military in World War II in combat. And after college graduation, he attended Union Theological Seminary in New York. Eventually finishing his PhD, he became a pastoral minister and was invited to attend the Amherst College's congregation. He was drawn to the psychology of Carl Jung, entered training to be a Jungian analyst in New York, and spent time studying also in Zurich. While in New York, he began three groups that ran 3 years, I believe.
20 years.
Oh, 20 years.
Three groups, 20 years.
Yeah, which is very impressive, and I'm sure it was wonderful for all. And you were influential in bringing group process to the Boston training as well, yeah, which has been wonderful. He wrote his thesis on a topic which developed out of his World War II experience. The title was Satan and Psyche, the Ego's Encounter with the Experience of Evil. And Thayer is one of the only people that I feel I can have a really deep conversation about this topic. I wish there were more people. Thayer has been immersed in the astonishing and complex journey of marriage for 63 years. Mm-hmm. In his words, quote, "I've made the journey with the beautiful, radiant soul, Anita. They have three beautiful daughters and five grandchildren." And I'd like to add a few words about Thayer's love of sports, particularly baseball. He's formulated and presented a course in many places in the U.S. entitled The Archetype of the Game, Sports as a Religious Experience. He has a passion and enthusiasm for baseball and is a fan par excellence. He has attended spring training with the Red Sox for many years. Note, there is no team without true fans. And in his words, he says, "My essential vocation is healing and transformation of the individual. My life, my profession has been, in part, a response to my war experiences. So thank you, Thayer, for all you've given to so many."
Thank you, Penny, for a beautiful introduction. I really appreciate it. Now, this is quite a turnout, so I gather either double trouble is something that concerns you or you want to avoid it. I'm going to start out. Anita found a quote from Rilke that I think captures what this is all about. "For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tests, or of all our tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation." And I think that's worth introducing what I'm about to address. 2 years ago, I gave a talk on being a couple, and I focus more on the issue of falling in love, courtship, the love experience, the best part of being a couple and connecting with someone. But being a double has a shadow. And so what I'm going to be addressing tonight is much more the shadow side of being a couple, whether it's married or long time living together, I think this applies, although I know you'll have to apply it in a somewhat different way, to same-sex couples, and I think it also applies to deep friendship, where you have a real soul connection with another friend. So I say that in beginning. I have a lot of material, and I will probably go until 9:15, and then give you a chance to ask some questions. I apologize, I can't give you more, but I have a lot to cover here. There are a lot of ways we can get in trouble. Now, the story of Eros and Psyche, or as Eros is known in English, Cupid, is a metaphor for falling in love, because Eros's arrows are tipped with a drug which, when piercing the flesh, can turn anyone hopelessly in love. Cupid is often portrayed with his eyes blindfolding, which suggests rather strongly that love can be very blind. And so I'm really addressing the post-Cupid, post-falling in love aspect. The honeymoon is over, dear. Now we begin to learn how to get real, if we can. I'm going to start with some sort of reality information, some empirical, statistical kinds of studies, and then move beyond that. John Gottman, who is out in Seattle, Washington, runs a big operation around working with couples and couples counseling, etc. And he has done the largest empirical studies of what happens with couples. And here are some of his discoveries. The chance of a first marriage ending in divorce over a 40-year period is 67%. Some studies find that a second marriage has a 10% higher rate than the first marriage. He then states, from years of observing, most marital arguments cannot be resolved. That should lift a great burden off. He then says, the four horsemen, the four horsemen of a negative couple of apocalypse, a conflicted relation, are the following: criticism, contempt, defensiveness, and stonewalling. In 85% of marriages, the stonewaller is the husband. Just to let you know, guys. And then he makes an interesting thing I didn't know. The male cardiovascular system is more reactive than the female and slower to recover from stress. Biologically, men are more easily overwhelmed by stress than their wives. Interesting information, that men are more likely impulsively to break off a difficult dialogue, partly because they can't handle as well as women can. I think this is true from many years of counseling with couples. The key to reviving a relationship is not how you handle disagreements, but in how you are with each other when you are not fighting. I think that's a very important point. One of the things that I ask couples who are having a lot of difficulty and getting a lot of arguments, and fights, I say, what are you like when you go on vacation? And if they do good vacations, or times when they can be together without the pressures of the external world, that is for me an encouraging sign. Somehow that can be a baseline, and then you can move toward dealing with conflict, misunderstanding, projection, etc. But it is not in itself necessarily problematic if a couple fight a lot. Anita and I can attest to that. We have had our marriage chart read by two different astrologers, very sophisticated astrologers, and when we walked in and sat down, the first thing each of them said to us, do you two fight a lot? And I said, yeah, as a matter of fact, we're quite confrontational. And they said, well, it doesn't surprise me. Your marriage chart is governed by Mars, the god of war. So you see, if the stars are that way, you may have to deal with it. But it doesn't mean you can't have a loving connection with each other. And we've gotten pretty good at it. Another piece of information from Gottman. Men who allow their wives to influence them have happier marriages and less likely to divorce. In other words, if the man will listen to the woman's wisdom and insight and instinct and feeling, and even if he doesn't get it, he lets her provide some guidance and leadership, the marriage is more likely to survive. Statistically speaking, when men are not willing to share power with the partner, there is an 81% chance that the marriage will self-destruct. So a man who unconsciously and instinctively feels he always has to be in control, somebody who has a fair amount of narcissism, for example, which, you know, is a plague on him ultimately, but it's also a plague on relationship, because there's a great need to be always in control. And that works very much against a more fluid, flexible, dialogical relationship for the couple. Next piece of statistical analysis. 80% of the time, it is the wife that raises the sticky issues. I suspect there are a few women in the group here tonight who could testify to that. Now, to raise the sticky issues is not a symptom of a troubled marriage, because it's equally true in most happy marriages that the wife will tend to raise the sticky issues. And there are many reasons for that that make sense. Next statistic. 67% of most marital conflicts fall into the category of perpetual problems. When choosing a long-term partner, you will inevitably be choosing a set of unsolvable problems that you will be grappling with for the next 10, 20, 50, or 63 years. So the thing that I sometimes run across with people, couples who come, or just other contacts I have, are, you know, we've been married for 50 years and we've never had an argument. I find that shocking. There's something not alive in that relationship, in my judgment. Two vital personalities who are autonomous and at the same time capable of intimacy are going to confront each other, are going to be deeply engaged. You know, we've lost the meaning of what it is to have a fiancé. To be engaged means to be grappling with each other, to be connected and working out, who is this person? How do I deal with him or her as part of the dynamic? He then writes, marriages are successful to the degree that the problems you choose are ones you can cope with. I think there's some truth. You know, when we fall in love and you know, falling in love is kind of nature's way. It's our fate that Cupid is going to shoot his arrow and we're going to be half blind at least in who we fall for. Part of what's happening is at an unconscious level, we are picking up from the other person some underlying dynamic that we're going to have to address in order that each of us can be more whole. One of our colleagues in Switzerland, who has now passed away, wrote a book, Marriage Dead or Alive. And he had a rather dour Swiss Protestant view of marriage, I think. I don't totally agree with him. But he said, marriage is not for happiness. It's for individuation. It's for growth. It's for becoming more whole in a dynamic relationship. And there's an awful lot of truth in that. I think you can do that and also have a lot of fun. Now I want to... Oh, I've got to get something out here. Excuse me for a minute. I want to read... I don't know whether any of you subscribe to The Sun, but I strongly recommend it. It's one of the best things to read I've ever come across. We discovered it about 3 years ago. And it's got great writers, and it says it like it is. It just cuts to the core of things. There's so much honesty in it. And a woman named Esther Perel, whose parents were Holocaust survivors, and she grew up in Belgium. She speaks and understands five languages. She's married and lives in New York, but she's international lecturer on marriage and relationship. And she's got a terrific article in here. It's an interview. And the interviewer says, you said that we ask a lot of marriage today, expecting it to satisfy needs that used to be handled by society, friendships, extended family, and so forth. What kind of pressure does this put on couples? Perel answers, too much. they crumble under the weight of expectations. I don't think people have ever demanded so much of a union of two people. Traditionally, marriage gave the partners family, children, respectability, social status, companionship, and economic security. Now, on top of everything else, we want our spouses to love us, to desire us, to be interested in us, to be our best friends and trusted confidants and passionate lovers to boot. And we live twice as long as we used to. Our demands are contradictory. Give me predictability. Give me surprise. Give me comfort. Give me life on the edge. Give me familiarity. Give me novelty. Sex toys and lingerie alone are not going to help with all that. Often I ask myself whether the couples who divorce aren't the true idealists. They believe in the model of one person who can provide them with everything. They think they just chose the wrong person and they'll do better next time. I think she's great. And this model is something new in human history? Perel says, yes. The institution of marriage has undergone an extreme makeover in the last century. Historically, a passionate marriage was a contradiction in terms. Matrimony was primarily a matter of economic sustenance. Love could grow between husband and wife, but it had little to do with why they got married. Sex was primarily for reproduction. You needed 8 children to work a farm, so you had 12, because 4 probably would not survive. If you experienced pleasure, that was a bonus, but it certainly wasn't guaranteed in the marriage contract. Modernity has ushered in marriage as a romantic arrangement where commitments are built on love, trust, and affection have become its sustainable energy source. In the West, romance and passion are at the center of the marital plot, and this holds for gay couples and straight couples, boomers and millennials alike. Then she goes on, author Stephanie Kuntz has written about how love conquered marriage. I've got her book right here. Then we brought sex into love, and for that we had to have the women's movement and the subsequent democratization of contraception. And we needed to be happy as well. So we brought happiness down from heaven. It used to belong to the afterlife and made what had been a pursuit into a mandate. People come to me because their spouse isn't making them happy. I don't think any of our grandparents would have considered that a reason to seek therapy. A passionate relationship in which we ask for novelty and mystery from the same person we look to for security and stability. That is a grand new invention in the history of humankind. And then she ends, the problem for most of my clients lies in the model as much as in the relationship. I think that is a major statement that gives perspective to all of us in regard to double trouble. Next, I want to share with you something that I almost always present in my first session with a couple who come to me for counseling. And I find that it's a part of the experience of many different therapists who describe it in different ways. When a couple come to me, I will ask them, so you're here because you've got a problem in your relationship with each other. And they, you know, I say, yeah, that's why we're here. Obviously, that's why we're here. And I say, well, I've got news for you. When you two walked in the door and sat down, you brought at least five relationships into this room. Five relationships. And it may take us quite a while before we get to the relationship between the two of you. And they're always intrigued by that response, but frankly, it's self-evident. There's first the model imprint of the parental marriages. When you are one, when you are two, when you are five, when you are seven, when you are ten, what you are absorbing unconsciously, because you don't have enough ego to discriminate, what you're absorbing is, so this is what it means to be married. This is marriage. That becomes the fundamental model. Whatever your parents' marriage was, you're carrying it around inside as a model, unconsciously. So we have to, in the counseling, we have to explore that, and we keep coming back to it over and over, but that's two different relationships. Each partner having a parental marriage that unconsciously they are using as a model for their own marriage. Then, and with it, there's the repetition of parental patterns. In other words, you get involved in interacting with your partner now, and you're not aware. You're doing it over. This is the merry-go-round. This is a closed circle. And you're really reenacting and repeating to a significant degree what your parents were doing with each other. And, you know, I have many couples and individuals, I would say, the one thing I'm not going to do is be like my mother or my father. Yeah. In one way or another, it's going to significantly influence how you relate to your partner. We are born into a system that has been internalized in our original families. Perhaps that is why the way it was feels to so many people like the way it has to be. Need to remain in a relational world which we know. Better to deal with the devil we know than one who is new and strange. Familiarity is a powerful force. Okay, so that takes care of two relationships so far in the room. Then there is the Oedipal marriage. This is a repetition of the relational dynamic with the opposite gender parent. The woman, the wife here, with the father, the husband, the man, with the mother. And I'll give you a rather amusing and delightful illustration of an Oedipal relationship between a daughter and a father. Anita and I had three daughters. They were all under the age of four, so I had an onslaught of the feminine. And our oldest daughter was just about four, a little older. The Oedipal stage starts somewhere 3 to 4 up to 6 usually. And it's called the Oedipal romance, in case you hadn't heard of it. So we were in our summer home, and Anita and I were kind of lazily lying in bed. The sun was shining. It was morning. Nice, beautiful summer day. And all of a sudden, our daughter came dancing into our bedroom, sort of giggling and full of, you know, lively energy. And she went around to Anita's side of the bed and crawled under the covers and crawled over Anita and snuggled down between us next to me. And she was there for a little while, not very long, but she was clearly enjoying being with Dad and Mom, but being with Dad. Then she turned around and put her little butt against my thigh and put her feet on Anita's thigh, and she shoved. And Anita rolled over and disappeared. Thud. And there was this silence. And then this confused, perplexed face of my wife appeared over the edge of the mattress. And I said, Oedipus Schmedipus, I win, you lose. And it's all true. I mean, that's what Dr. Freud based his theory on to a significant degree. And that relationship continues in your life in one form or another. The present father, the absent father, the loving father, the critical father, and the same for the mother, carry enormous impact. So, what I'm saying is that the father complex, using Jung's terminology, the mother complex, the brother or sister complex. Anita did not marry her dad, she married her brother. I won't go into the details, but the internalized unconscious image and relational dynamic which is projected onto the partner and then reacted to in a repetition of childhood experience. I now have to share a dream of my own, which causes me, well, I'm not really embarrassed about it, but after something like 15 to 20 years of marriage, it wasn't shortly after we got married. We've been married quite a while. One evening after supper and the kids had gone upstairs to study, Anita, sitting at the dinner table, said, Thayer, we have to talk. Those are famous words in most couples' relationships. And I said, so, what do we need to talk about? And she said, I am really, really tired of you reacting to me as though I were your mother. I'm not your mother. I'm Anita. And I had by that time been practicing as a well-trained, fully conscious, well-analyzed Jungian analyst for, 8-9 years, you know? And so I said to her, I said, Anita, I don't think that's true at all. I think I'm reacting to you. And she said, sometimes you react to me, but sometimes I feel like your mother is between you and me. And I said, well, I don't agree. So we went to bed and I had a dream. This is where dreams are both useful, illuminating, and sometimes embarrassing and a bit painful. In the dream, I was entering our master bedroom in our home down in Westchester County, and there was Anita sitting up in bed looking beautiful, waiting for me to join her, and I started taking off. I was more dressed up when I had to go to New York than I ever am here, thank God. And so I was taking off my jacket and my tie, and I looked around, and there was my mother sitting up in bed, waiting for me to join her. And so I took off my clothes and got in my pajamas and looked around, and there was Anita sitting up in bed. And I went in and brushed my teeth and peed and came out, and there was my mother waiting for me to join her. And when I woke up in the morning, I do believe in dreams as the voice of truth from the unconscious. Some of the symbolism is fairly complex, but this was not complex symbolism. And went down to breakfast, and I said, "Sweetheart, I had a dream." And I might say I was a bit chagrined, naturally, but I told her the dream and said, "You were correct. Clearly, at an unconscious level, sometimes I project my mother complex on you. And when I do, I'm reacting to you not as you, but as though you were in some way a stand-in for my mother. And I don't like that. And you don't like it. So next time that happens, you feel that, you tell me in the moment so that I can process it and we can work it through." Because that's what you do when you get a dream that gives you that kind of inner truth. And so there was my Oedipal bond to my mother, who was the primary figure in my developmental life. We are all in one way inevitably affected by this. I worked with a man in the New York area who was a rather well-known figure in the financial business, and he was an elitist, and he was a good man, but he had had a very difficult mother, and the impression that I got was that he had been compliant, acquiesced, sort of avoided ever confrontation. And so one day he came in with a dream where this very primal, aggressive, big, dark figure who told him what he was going to do to my client's mother in fairly obscene language, and there was no doubt that he was about to do it. Well, in Jungian terminology, we had met his shadow, and what had been repressed and unconscious for all these years, and this was a man in his 60s, was the power that his mother had had over him that was only now finally boiling up in a rather brutal, primal, masculine figure that wanted to put his mother in her place. It was gold for me, because then I could, you know, begin to work with that shadow side of him, which he always kept his cool. He was CEO of a big operation, etc. And it made a difference, thank heavens. Now, the actual empirical experience of the couple relationship, what we're finally getting now to the couple. We've had four relationships, if you remember. So what the question then is, what will it take for me to be my unique and authentic me, and for you to be your unique and authentic you? Because if you have the illusion that that's easy to come by, you're in trouble, double trouble. Because to become an authentic, present, engaged partner with another human being is a challenge, a real challenge, a lifetime challenge, I would say. Wouldn't you? She's nodding her head. It is risky to explore our vulnerabilities, but one becomes more real and more alive and truly present by doing so. So, that's a critical issue. One can either engage in a relationship of blame and shame, usually going both ways, or one can learn to engage in a relationship of vulnerability versus vulnerability. That takes risk. Courage, commitment to the relationship. It's scary. It's makes one uncomfortable, and it's, in my judgment, absolutely necessary if there's going to be an essential truth between two people. The need to accept vulnerability in oneself and in one's partner without turning away. You may be embarrassed by the vulnerability of the part. For God's sake, don't get real with me. Then I'd have to get real, is one of the issues. Men are more likely to hide their vulnerability, their vulnerable underbelly, I write, due to cultural conditioning. You know, Kennedys don't cry. The Marine Corps does not encourage and recognize vulnerability. One of the problems with all the veterans coming back with PTSD is, man, you're supposed to be strong. You're falling apart. And it's only been in the last, I think, maybe 5 years that we've had so many, and it's been gotten so much press that we're beginning to be open to it. I remember sitting in an armored half-track in a big advance we were making across Germany, and suddenly we started getting shelled, and there were shells exploding not too far from our half-track, and I saw a guy in our squad sitting opposite me just totally disintegrate. He didn't plan to do that. He didn't want to do that. He was overtaken. He just had it. He couldn't hold it together anymore. And I get so angry with armchair warriors, to start with, who've never been under fire, as many of our political leaders have not, who then... Cheney got five, whatever you call them, deferments. Bush never got in, never had a bullet fired at him, and the people in the Pentagon, some of the top people, never been in combat. That's a different lecture. So it is really difficult for women, for sure, but men even more so, to really let down their guard, to be openly scared, to weep, to cry, to feel helpless, to feel needy. And it's so important for the woman as well as the man, because then she feels her feeling, her instincts can reach out and she can love the man. When he's big and strong and powerful and controlling and abrupt, she gets squashed. That's not a relationship. There are times where vulnerability is not met by the partner. It doesn't always work in the moment. It takes patience and psychic courage not to withdraw or shut down, but to remain open. Each of us has a sensitive and often wounded inner child who is more often hidden than allowed to be present and expressed in a couple's relationship. But that child is the key that unlocks the door of deeper mutuality and intimacy. We bring a little kid with us into our relationships, and certainly into our most committed and intimate relationship. And if we lock that kid away, if we ignore what that kid's trying to tell us, to tell our adult ego, then we're going to have double trouble. One of the things that Anita and I learned with a lot of analysis and a lot of relatedness between us was to let that child speak to the partner. And almost always it changed the nature and dynamic of the relationship. There was empathy, there was receptiveness, there was awareness of where the other was coming from. So it is critically important to have some awareness, not only of who you are, but of who you were and how you've come from there, but you're still connected with that inner child. Now I want to talk about projection. One of my colleagues wrote in a book, wherever projection occurs, the person who carries the projected image is either greatly overvalued or greatly undervalued. In other words, projection leads to an unrealistic perception and reaction to the person that you're unconsciously projecting on. Projection is not a dynamic the conscious ego does. The conscious ego has no control over the projection. A projection is something that happens to us. And it happens to us and through us, is what I wrote. we attach to another person some qualities and characteristics that are part of our own unconscious attitudes and earlier experience. The clinical term projective identification is a dynamic where we put into our partner some negative element that is in fact part of our own unconscious psychology that we have repressed and refused to acknowledge as our own. So we then try to correct it in our partner with a blaming and critical attack. And you can see where that leads. You're really unconsciously putting into your partner something you don't want to deal with in yourself. And then you blame, you shame, you criticize, and it doesn't get anywhere. I mean, it's a little like me projecting my mother complex onto my wife. So projection is inevitable, but beginning to be aware, and you usually need the feedback of the other person, there, I'm not your mother. My colleague writes, to the extent that a relationship is founded on projection, the element of human love is lacking. That's in contrast with the dynamic of being in love, falling in love, which is not loving. Being in love is different than loving. It's an early stage of an attraction. And if you insist that it be constantly perpetuated, you're going to have a real problem, as the article I read. You know, you'll give up on that relationship and be in love with somebody else until the in love doesn't work anymore and you don't know how to love, so you got to move on to the next in love experience. Many people prefer to go from one person to another, always looking for the ultimate relationship, always leaving the relationship when the projections wear off and the in-loveness ends. The other side of projection, which is very important, I don't think that the Creator would have given us the aptitude and capacity for projection if it wasn't needed in some way. Most love relationships begin with projection, he writes, and this serves life. In other words, projection gets you involved. Projection pulls you in. And then when you're in it, you need to work through the projection and get to the reality of the relationship. Next, I want to talk about typology. How many of you here are familiar with the Myers-Briggs typology indicator? Oh, I'm glad. Good. For your information, I am an ENFP. I used to believe I was an ENTP, but my dreams and a wise analyst helped me to really recover my auxiliary function. which is introverted feeling. I'm an extroverted intuitive, in case you didn't know that by now. For those of you who are not familiar with Jung's typological theories and the way they are used in the Myers-Briggs typology indicator, there's extroversion and introversion, and we tend to predominate in one or the other. There are some people that are best described as ambiverts. In other words, they're sort of in the middle. Then there are four different ego functions: thinking, feeling, intuition, sensation. And I don't have time to go into the characteristics of each, but I'm an extroverted intuitive. Surprise, surprise, I married someone who was once upon a time an introverted sensate. Now when we go to a party, she wants to stay longer and I want to go home. So I've become more introverted and she's become
you
more...
You always were a closet introvert.
She's probably right. So when I work with couples, a research project done quite a number of years ago, back maybe 30, 40 years ago, where they didn't use the Myers-Briggs, they used another type test called the Gray Wheelwright, which is simpler. It's the one I use often with clients and with couples, because it, I think, gets to basically the same place. But they used that one, and they gave it to 3,000 couples. And what they found was that 90% of couples marry their opposite type. Now, there's a pretty good reason for that. Let's say that you are an introverted sensate thinker, maybe a judger. The part of you that is unconscious is intuition and feeling. So that's a dotted line. This is a full line. So you wander through life and all of a sudden you meet somebody and something feels right. Something feels like there's a connection. You may not wildly fall in love. It often isn't the most passionate meeting you've ever had. But it feels comfortable. It feels safe in some important way. And you feel like, I feel okay with this person. On my fourth date after I met Anita on a blind date. On my fourth date, I came back to my Amherst fraternity, and my fraternity brothers asked me, "So how did it go with Anita tonight?" And I said instinctively, "I'm going to marry that woman." And a year and a half later, with a lot of persuasion, I managed to. But she was 19 when I met her. So there's this connection. And for a while in the couple relationship, there's a sense of wholeness. There's a sense of completion. There's a sense of balance. But it doesn't last. Because over time, something inside us compels us to say to each of us, you've got to begin to fill in the dotted line, buddy. You can't lean on her to do it. And so there's a a separation, a split apart. There's double trouble often. And the double trouble is necessary because we live on earth and not in some ideal paradise, and you are being compelled to begin to work on yourself and fill in the dotted line as best you can, which usually isn't very well, but you got to take responsibility for it. You can't unconsciously dump it on the other person. So that is the story of typology. We first meet our other side in our partner through projection and some instinct, and it works for a while, and then it doesn't work so well. Now, I'll give you a rather amusing little detail from fairly early in our marriage. My sensation function is abysmal, and Anita, she instinctively can deal with the sensate world, with objects and details, all kinds of things that overwhelm me. And when I grew up in a family that had a cook and a maid, I was really privileged. And so in the morning, when I get up to go to school, I take off my pajamas and leave them lying on the floor, get clothes, my clothes on, dash down, get my breakfast, and take off for school. And not too long after we got married, Anita had that famous phrase, "There, we need to talk." And I said, "What do we need to talk about?" She said, "This is going to be hard for you, but there are no more magical pajamas." You grew up, and for you, the pajamas were left on the floor, and magically, they were hanging on a hook the next evening. She said, "The magical pajamas have lost their magic, and I'm not going to pick them up. So if you don't pick them up, they're going to be on the floor." And for 2 days, they were lying there because it took me a while to adjust. But that's a kind of amusing example of typological difference, plus having a maid. But in working with couples, this issue of typology, I find, is a valuable starting point in helping them to realize how opposite they are. And therefore, unless they are, you know, really studied typology and taken the Myers-Briggs and worked on dealing with their inferior functions, people assume everybody is really very much the same. They're like me. Baloney. I mean, I can remember when we were over in Zurich and I was in my training, I was reading Jung's volume on typology, and I read about the extroverted intuitive, and I felt right at home. Yeah. This is life. This is what I'm like. And then I read the introverted sensate, and I came out in the other room and I said, "Anita," I read a few sentences, "Is that the way you are?" And she said, "Yeah, that's home, that feels natural." I said, "We live on different planets." So opposite typology is not a small thing. It's a big issue until you begin to appreciate the value and the support that you get from your opposite-sided typological partner. And that doesn't stop it from being annoying.
No, there are still things after 63 years that I don't like about you and you don't like about me.
True.
So be it.
Oh, we're going to stay married, right? I just need a little reassurance. So, one of the ways of looking at this opposition and many others, and I do this a lot with couples when they're getting hot with each other, which is usually a good sign in a counseling situation. And they're being real. They're showing who they are. But typology is a good example because everybody constitutionally is one type or another. You are constitutionally from birth. And so your typology is not a fault, it's a phenomenon. And there are many other areas in couples' relatedness where if you can look at it not as a fault or a failure, but as a phenomenon. What the hell's going on between us right now? You know, we're mad as hell at each other. What's going on? You know, I don't feel like I'm being fully myself right now. I've been taken over by something. Have you? And very often the answer is, yeah, we're caught. That's a phenomenon. It's not a fault. It's not a failure. It's something to look at, to step back from, and try to understand a bit more, inch by inch. Okay. Now, we get to the issue of boundaries, permeable and impermeable. Or permeable and firm, not impermeable, but firm. Many people, when they're young and they meet someone, there is, and they're pulled in by the in-love experience and their attraction, and they feel deeply longing and wanting to connect and attach. And this is often described as the urge to merge. Or a fusion relationship, where there's a loss of individual separate identity and sense of self. But, you know, we shall be one. Trying to think of the Hindu image of that and the god and the goddess, I can't think of it right now. And so this urge to merge is in deep tension or opposition to what Buber writes about in his book I-Thou, if you've ever read it. An I-Thou relationship is one in which I have a strong sense of me, and I'm experiencing a thou, not an it, but a thou. Buber writes about I-it relationships, I-Thou relationships. To have an I-Thou relationship is to experience in some way the essence of another human being. It's what I really try, I feel this is the essential element in being a psychotherapist. For me to have a clear, grounded sense of there, and then to come to understand and experience the thou in my client. It takes a lot of listening, among other things. Couples need to listen to each other. So this raises the issue of autonomy versus intimacy. And so many couples get hung up on this one. Either their longing for intimacy, for merging, is so great that they tend to sacrifice or lose, or maybe they've never fully had their sense of autonomy, of an individual identity and being. Or they have such a strong need to maintain their separate identity that it's very difficult for them to let it flow toward intimacy and connection and feel safe. And the paradox is, the more secure your autonomy is, the more capable you are of intimacy. That's the paradox. It is not being secure in your autonomy, in your sense of I and me, that then makes it difficult to be fully intimate, because it can suck you in, it can take you over, can make you lose a sense of your own identity in that relationship. And that's a major issue that creates double trouble. I think I've got time to read you. This is by a woman named Maggie Scharf. She's written some very good books on intimate relationship, marriage, couples, whatever. And she describes five levels of the capacity for relatedness and intimacy. The fifth level, which is the least, we work down to one, which is the most. She calls this paradox. Intimacy is the very negation of autonomy. Autonomy is the negation of closeness. Being close and being separate feel equally dangerous. That's the most problematic level. Level 4, projective identification. Both partners are struggling with an inner conflict about being close and achieving a separate individual identity. They deal with it by dividing the needs up between them. Each splits off and represses and projects into the partner whichever side of the internal dispute he or she has disavowed, either the capacity for intimacy or the capacity for autonomy. They're split, and one gets put into the partner rather than both being stably grounded and related within each. So that's the fourth level, projective identification. Level 3, conscious splitting. The key difference in level 3 is that even though the spouses are projected unwanted thoughts and feelings onto each other, they are more conscious of doing so. Each is able, when the smoke clears, to take ownership of that dark, split-off side of the internal battle, the need to be close or to be separate. I mean, that's a real achievement. You still have the projective dynamic, you still have plenty of smoke and explosions, but then you back off and you can process it and take back and own what you projected into the other person. She goes on, what is introduced at level 3 is a greater awareness of complexity, of a conflict within the self as well as a conflict with the intimate partner. Tremendously important point. We have an internal double trouble that we carry with us all the time. And if we are unable to recognize an internal tension of opposites, then one of those opposites is going to get put on the partner and on a lot of other people also, I think, in the world. So recognizing that is a big step. That's, you know, my goal in working with couples is to help them to get to that point. That level 2, tolerating ambivalence. Spouses at this higher level of separation and individuation can take conscious ownership of both sides of the fundamental inner conflict. The level 2 partner is able to endure the tensions generated by this conflict without transforming them into a conflict between himself, herself, and the other partner. And then level 1. Integrated relationship. It's less an interpersonal reality than an ideal. I would agree with that. The inner experience is that being close and being separate are equally safe and equally gratifying. Both are acceptable all of the time. No conflict between them that requires resolution. Couples at this level perceive autonomy and intimacy as states of being. Being close to the partner supports being a distinct, separate person. Intimacy is an internalized state of being. I can feel near to my partner no matter where I am or whatever I happen to be doing in that moment. At higher levels of separation and individuation, a couple's intimate relationship takes the form of dialogue between two separate beings, rather than the form of fusion and interpersonal merger. That's a pretty darn good description of the stages of movement towards intimacy with oneself that allows intimacy with the partner. And at this point I want to quote another wonderful statement by Rilke in his Letters to a Young Poet. I read one at the very beginning about that our life is a preparation for our capacity to love and to be close. I often, you know, I'm still an ordained parson, and I occasionally get asked to conduct a wedding with friends, or I married off all of my daughters, etc. Most of my relatives that are young, and but quite a lot of friends. And one thing that Rilke says is, I can't remember the quote exactly, but he says, the deepest level of love is for the lover to stand guard over the beloved's solitude. And I just think that is so profoundly true. To stand guard over the beloved's solitude. I think that applies not only to one's real partner, but to that part of oneself that one needs to learn to love and to allow it to have solitude. Out of that solitude comes richer capacities to love, poetry, art, creativity, various kinds. Okay.
Is it time to stop?
No.
I just feel everyone spilling up with questions.
I'm going to finish. I'll try to go faster, but the next issue is narcissism and control and the autonomous other. You got that?
Right on. Perfect.
That is kind of funny, isn't it? When one is a narcissist or one has a narcissistic partner, you got a problem. Because one of the things that narcissism is based on is, for want of a better term, some wound to the inner sense of self. There's not a secure sense of one's own being, individuality, identity within. And narcissism compensates for that. And it means you've got to control the environment and control other people. And so another person, namely a partner, is not being experienced as an autonomous other that one needs to approach and listen to and come to know in his or her uniqueness. The partner is an extension of my own self system. In other words, the partner is really a part of me, and I want him or her to be the way I need them to be in order for me to feel good about myself. And that's a narcissistic characteristic. And by and large, partners don't get really enthusiastic about this. So what's called for to overcome that is to learn what I call an empathic mirroring, a capacity to listen, to be empathic, and really receive the uniqueness, otherness, mystery, weirdness sometimes of the other person. Rather than to somehow fix them. Men particularly feel when a woman is upset or is having a fit or is depressed, they gotta fix it. No, they don't have to fix it. She'll fix it. What they need is for you to be an empathic mirror. Wow, you're really feeling bad today. What's getting you down? What's getting you down? I can feel your energy is so low. Something's brought this about. What is it, sweetheart? That's empathic mirroring. Oh boy, I got to do something to make her feel good. I got to fix her. And I wish she'd be what I need her to be, and I don't like her depressed. Next. Persona shadow dynamics. Being an authentic person means, in Jungian terms, we have to assimilate and integrate our own dark side, the side that we would like to split off and not have to acknowledge. But if we can assimilate it and begin to integrate it, then we just naturally become more real. When the shadow is missing from a personality, there's a loss of vitality and instinct in the relationship. It's like somebody's hollow. They're not there because they're not connected with their own guts, with their own inner energy. Some of you may have read Robert Bly's book on Iron John, The Wild Man. And I don't have time to go into it. I recommend that book for the men particularly. I worked with a couple many years ago, and the husband was such a proper man. And he was a nice guy. He was smart. He made a good living. But he had a mother that had trained him to always be proper. And his wife naturally picked somebody who was pretty adventurous and really wanted action, and she had a wild side to her. And, you know, it drove her nuts. And he had the following dream in which he was driving his car and his wife was sitting next to him, and in the back seat was another couple. And I said, "So tell me about this couple." And he said, "They are the most conventional, traditional couple I've ever known." And I said, "Oh, isn't that interesting? They're driving in the back seat of your car. I wonder what that could be telling you." It helped a little. But that is the absence of shadow. I'm going to share briefly an experience I had. Still got 5 minutes. And this was when we were in Zurich and I was studying at the Institute, and something occurred in my life over there that I'm not going to give you the details of, but I became murderously enraged. So that I, much more than when I was trying to kill in the army, I was really ready to really do damage. And it shocked me and upset me that I was taken over by this. So I went off for a walk in the Zurich woods on a nice sunny May day and sat down next to a tree. And if you had a strong affect, the affect is connected with an image. Affect and image are always related to each other. So I sat down and I closed my eyes and I kind of put myself in a light trance. And I said, "So who the hell are you, murderous rage?" And what emerged almost immediately was a big, brown, hairy ape. I had gone ape. And I said, "Who are you? Where did you come from?" He said, "Thayer, you've had me locked in a cage all of your life. And I just got out. And I got news for you. I'm not going back in." I said, "You're dangerous. I don't know what to do with you. You could be very destructive." And he basically said, "It's your choice. I'll either be your ally or I'll be your adversary. But I'm here for good, and you got to deal with me." So that was a big experience. So I painted a picture of this ape and me standing next to him. And I gave it to my wonderful Jungian analyst in Zurich, a woman who was terrific. She'd been analyzed by Jung for 15 years. And she really had it together. And she looked at the picture and then she turned it around and she said, "Thayer, do you see how you've portrayed the ape?" and it was big and brown and hairy and full of energy and force. And how you've portrayed yourself, and I wasn't a stick figure, but I was a very bland, sort of Casper Milquetoast-like figure. And she leaned forward and smiled at me and said, "There, speaking as a woman, I prefer the ape." The greatest gift, or one of them I ever received in analysis. My mother never would have said that. Okay, I'm going to skip a bit. I need to end by talking about how does this get repaired? How does this get transformed? I think I've given you a lot of clues, but the answer I get when people say, "Thayer, what is the fundamental key to an enduring relationship?" And I say it is the capacity on the part of both partners for an individuation dialogue. That's the enduring basis for a relationship. And what I mean by that is you don't stonewall, you don't do a lot of shame and blame, you look at it phenomenologically as best you can. You are vulnerable with the other and you don't pull away. You let your inner child come forward and be seen and known by the other. In the course of a lengthy relationship, we've been married for 63 years and known each other for 65. And when Anita and I guess we've been married, for 40 years anyway, 45. We went out to dinner with a couple, and the man was in his sixth marriage. And he was remarking to Anita at the dinner table, "You know, it has been astonishing to me that in this marriage I found a level of love and relationship that I never believed was possible in my life." Two or three of his wives had died. And Anita said, "Yeah, Thayer and I are in our sixth marriage too. And a couple of the earlier ones were real bummers." And the wife, the woman, was a literary agent. And she said, "There's a book in that idea." Unfortunately, we've never written a book. So my final statement, which really comes from Mary Louise von Franz, a famous Jungian analyst: every couple relationship is unique and individual and must be approached from that perspective. There is no one model that will contain the complex variety of human relationship between two human beings. It is our adventure, now this is me talking, it is our adventure and exploration of the not yet known, but it helps to have a flashlight and a rough map from others who have made the journey. Thank you very much. Okay, we've got 15 minutes for questions.
Please know that we're recording this too. So if you don't want to be recorded, just tell us and we'll shut it off.
None of you have troubles?
Okay. Could you state, please, the issue of the Sun magazine?
This issue is... oop. Well, I'm all wet anyway. December 2013, issue 456. Any other questions?
Could you discuss using this type of work, dealing with siblings and family members in the shadow?
Oh, yeah. Oh, boy. Talk about shadow with siblings. I mean, the thing you see in family systems with siblings, I think particularly when, you know, you've got two or three boys or two or three girls, is that partly out of their constitutional makeup, partly out of the parental response to each one, and the birth order issue, they develop a certain style and individuality within the family system. And they tend not, for a lot of understandable reasons developmentally, but some sibling will carry some elements of their own human nature that they don't have to be responsible for, or they can't get to. And there's a lot of sibling rivalry often, or division of psychic consciousness would be another way of putting it. And I mentioned that Anita married her brother because her brother was a very strong character and was born 13 months after Anita was born and became the apple of her mother's eye, and Anita played second fiddle, even though she was the oldest and all of that. And so Anita's father was, I don't want to be unkind to him, but he wasn't very strong or very present. And her brother was. He was a remarkable guy. And I'm happy to be a stand-in, but I got a little tired of her reacting to me in some ways that felt as though she was really reacting to her brother. So there's a sibling example. Other question? Yes.
So if you would speak more about avoidance, stonewalling, why does that happen?
That's a very, I'm glad you asked that question. It has to do with what we broadly call our defenses, and it usually indicates that for one reason or another, in childhood, there was a need to defend in some way, to protect oneself. It can be very subtle, it can be very unconscious between the parent and the child, but it exists. And so all of us, to some degree, I would say, build a fortress. And in the fortress, we are safe and secure, and we're protecting our very core, our deep inner self. That's why the fortress is built. But then we grow up, and we go out into the world, and we begin to have relationships, and marriages, and friendships. And there's a real problem, because people don't like talking to a fortress. It's not much fun. And you feel like, unless this person lets the drawbridge down and comes out in the open field, how am I ever going to get to him or her? And so there's an enormous need to understand that what was a fortress has become a prison. It's now a prison. You don't need the fortress. You can go out and be authentic and vulnerable and real and loving and receptive and fun and all those things with other people. And sometimes it'll hurt and sometimes it'll give you joy. Yes?
So the fortress keeps the faith in prison.
Oh, yeah.
One of the fears is if you... the male, for me, if I don't stonewall, I'm afraid I'll let the ape out. So how do you, how did you integrate your ape?
I used to have a big, brown, hairy beard. And I grew that about 2 months after I had that ape experience. And it was a conscious decision. I wanted to be brown and hairy and begin to appropriate. Part of it was, and a lot of it came much later, thanks in part to my remarkable partner. She always had a capacity for anger, and I was a minister's son, and I was a really nice guy and very charming. And that was the way I got by. And at one point, after many years of marriage, something, I don't know what it was, that ticked me off, but I was enraged. And I hot lava came out of my mouth at Anita, and I was really totally out of control, except I didn't have to do the ape thing. And finally, when the dust settled a bit, I said, "Boy, you didn't deserve all that." And she said a wonderful thing, just like my analyst in Zurich. She said, "Thayer, I've always known I was a bitch, but you're just discovering what a bastard you are." What more could one ask for in a loving relationship? Okay, I think my time... What did I do with my watch? Oh, I put it on my... Oh, no. We've got 5 minutes more. Any more questions? Yes?
Can you say more about the inner child, showing it, what that looks like, illustrated?
That's a good question. Say more about the inner child, what that looks like. It was quite a long time before I really began to have an image and a sense of connection with little boy Thayer. One of the things that helped me a lot is in our summer home, there's a picture of me when I was about 4 years old, would you say?
Five.
4 or 5. And you saw this picture of this bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, really alive, looking right into the camera, little guy. And then there's a picture of me when I'm about 7 or 8 with, it's kind of a family picture with my very powerful grandmother and my cousins. And there's this wistful kid looking away from the camera. Totally different look. And a lot of me went underground. And so I remember those two pictures, and I particularly looked to that 4 to 5 year old picture. And I think he was here tonight with you folks. And when he gets pissed off, or when he gets hurt, or when he gets excited, he really lets it out. He lets people experience it and see it. And it's been, you know, Anita and I, over many years, have learned to share the empty places, the hurt places, but the joy places and the wonderful aspects of that inner child that is always the basis at some point for who we are now. And so, you know, one of the things that I did at one period where I was working on all this, I used to look in the mirror and say, who are you? You know, really, who are you? And it was that kind of encouragement that helped me to make conscious that little boy inside me.
No, the ongoing, persistent willingness for dialogue is very important, because the way that Thayer would come back at me was the only way I knew he wasn't my father, he wasn't my brother, he wasn't some other kind of projection. He was himself. And because he was able to stand his ground and be himself, and I could do that also many times, that helped us deal with the projections.
Yeah, and, you know, that answer I gave to my fraternity roommate, I've had, shall we say, a series of girlfriends for quite some time, and I had a good time, but my problem was they kind of glommed on to me. I realized over time, I'm not sure I really feel comfortable being adored. And it was a sense of, you know, merge. They wanted to merge. And I didn't want to be merged. I wanted to be an independent corporation. And when I met her, by the fourth date, I knew I was dealing with a woman who was not going to glom onto me and adore me. And it was, I felt relief. I told my roommate, I said, I've met my match. And I think that's what each of us hopes that we'll do. We'll meet our match. And part of the match was a hell of a lot of hard work to go through all that I've been describing this evening. But we were partners in matchmaking. Yenta. Okay, thank you very much. You've been a great audience.